Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. Heading to the beach this summer for a vacation? You're not alone. For centuries, the beach has been a popular vacation spot. Find out what has made it such a popular destination when Talking History's Eileen Dugan talks with Lang Lenchek, one of the authors of the book, The Beach, The History of Paradise on Earth. But before we do that, let's take a look at an important event that occurred this week in history. At the time of his death in 1996, former U.S. State Department employee and alleged communist spy Alger Hiss remained the subject of considerable public debate. During this week in 1948, controversy surrounding Hiss's career began when an admitted communist, Whitaker Chambers, testified before a televised hearing of the House Committee on Un-American Activities that the up-and-coming government official was a member of a communist underground cell operating in the United States during the 1930s. Weeks later, Chambers repeated his charges on NBC's Meet the Press and later produced microfilm and other State Department documents that he insisted Hiss gave him in secret meetings. Hiss denied any such involvement, and many supported him, countercharging that he was the victim of Cold War anti-communist hysteria. Hiss was indicted by a federal grand jury on two counts of perjury, the statute of limitations on espionage having run out, convicted and sentenced to a 5-year prison term in a federal penitentiary. After his release, Hiss attempted to exonerate himself, but he failed to secure a new trial. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, it's difficult to imagine the impact of an asteroid large enough to wipe out nearly all life on Earth, but a recent discovery gives evidence of one such collision. Scientists have discovered a 75-mile crater in Australia, which they believe was created 250 million years ago when a giant asteroid struck the Earth, kicking up immense amounts of dust that blocked the sun and led to the extinction of nearly three-quarters of the world's animal population. This mass extinction made way for the appearance of the dinosaurs, but they too perished in much the same manner when another asteroid struck the Earth 70 million years ago. Over 46,000 artifacts and memorabilia of America's 16th and perhaps greatest president, Abraham Lincoln, will soon be given a proper home. For over a century, valuable items such as Lincoln's marriage license, his White House china, and one of 5 known copies of the Gettysburg Address have been stored behind sheets of protective glass in the basement of the old Illinois State Capitol building. Soon they will be housed in the nation's largest presidential library built in Springfield, Illinois, where Lincoln spent most of his adult life. The Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library will take up almost 2 full blocks in the capital city. You're listening to Talking History.
It was 1960, teeny weeny, yellow polka dot bikini that she wore for the first time today. And in the 1960, teeny weeny, yellow polka dot bikini, so in the locker she was safe.
The Greeks and Romans spent their time there, but medieval Christians did not. In which camp do you fall, those who love the beach or those who shun it? For this week's interview, Talking History's Eileen Dugan explores the history of the beach as a vacation spot.
Sand and surf, seagulls wheeling overhead, kids building sandcastles, moms keeping watch over picnic lunches and the latest paperback bestseller, young women strolling along the water's edge, sporting the latest, most daring swimwear, young men noisily roughhousing, stopping only to watch the girls walk by. To many of us, this is the beach. Why do we love the beach? How has the beach become a sort of paradise to so many? With us today to discuss the evolution of beach culture is Dr. Lena Lenchek, professor of Russian literature and humanities at Reed College. Dr. Lenchek is the co-author, with Dr. Gideon Bosker, of several books on beach culture, including The Beach, The History of Paradise on Earth, published by Viking Books, Beach, a literary anthology of stories by the Sand and Sea, published by Marlowe Books, and Beaches, a collection of spectacular photographs of beaches around the world, published by Chronicle Books of San Francisco. Welcome, Dr. Lenchek.
Hi, Eileen. How are you?
I'm just fine.
Great.
What is it about the beach that attracts people?
Well, Eileen, just as you mentioned in your introduction, in your lyrical introduction, I think there are probably 3 key things that attracts people to the beach. The first is, of course, physiological, with its unbeatable combination of oxygen, saturated air, water, and sun. The beach is nature's most potent antidepressant, and it just makes us feel good. to be at the beach. The second key reason is, I think, psychological. The beach is a 24/7 spectacle with no reruns. There is never a moment where the beach is the same. From moment to moment, it changes. So in this sense, it satisfies our ingrained lust for novelty. And I think finally, there's a cultural motive for this. The beach is a place where we can return to childhood. We can play with gay abandon. It's a place where we come to have our most significant erotic experiences. Some of us, or most of us actually, have our first erotic experiences at the beach. We can watch strangers bare their bodies, and we come there to celebrate our honeymoons, our childbearing years. We bring our children to the beach, and then we retire by the beach. So it's everything from Eros to Thanatos gets played out culturally on the beach. So the beach is really a site of relaxation and rejuvenation and congregation and spiritualization and mystery and good fun.
That's how we perceive the beach now, but have people always enjoyed the beach?
Well, the short answer to that is no, actually, they haven't. The historical record tells us that the peoples of the Mediterranean and of tropical South Sea islands did have a tradition of pleasure at the beach. But the peoples of Northern Europe, of the East Asian cultures did not. There were powerful religious motives that made the beach a site, a taboo site. Also, the beach was always a kind of precarious line of combat. Just as geologically, it's a site where constantly land and water lock in combat. So it was also the place where armies gathered to launch journeys of colonial conquest. It was the gateway of plagues and illnesses, of devastating, destructive storms. So the preconditions, as we see historically, for pleasure at the beach were really, both historically and in a more immediate way, a mild climate, a certain critical level of civilization and infrastructure that allowed for leisure time, for access to the coast, and, very important, a cultural ideology of hedonism. The ancient Greeks, and to a much greater extent, the ancient Romans had this, the peoples of the South Seas as well, let's say the medieval Christians lacked it 100%.
Yeah, I mean, how did the Greeks and Romans, for example, differ in their attitudes towards the beach?
Well, the ancient Greeks, looked at the beach as the place for religious, for military, and for athletic feats. We can look at the Odyssey and the Iliad, for example, in which Homer speaks of the beach as the site of battles, of religious sacrifice, of struggle for survival. Among the Greeks, swimming was a skill that all men learned as an attribute of their harmonious education. But it was really the ancient Romans who colonized the beach for pleasure. The Romans cherished the beautiful views out on water, the vistas. Theirs, we have to remember, was a culture of a very extensive aquaticism. Wherever ancient Romans went, they built baths. They built natatoria. At the beach, they actually established something that is a prelude to our working holiday. They called it the otium cum dignitate, or rest with dignity, a special protocol for relaxing at the beach. We find that all of the great Roman statesmen, philosophers, thinkers would retire during the hot summer months to the beach where they built extravagant villas in order to recharge their batteries. They invited their friends. They disputed philosophical and political issues, exercised, and drank fine wine. So the beach was for the Romans really part an extension of their aquatic culture.
And yet in the Middle Ages, much of that came crashing down. Medieval society seemed to reject the beach. How so?
Yes, well, the early Christians sought to ideologically distinguish themselves from the hedonistic culture of the Romans, and so they associated the beach with this hedonism, with the Romans' pagan lax sexuality and their emphasis on this worldliness. The early Christian spin on the beach was to make it a place of spirituality, to really spin doctor it, if you will. By selectively reading the Bible, they framed the beach as the place that would serve as a perpetual stern reminder of man's sinful nature. What do I mean? Well, they pointed out that Eden, as it was first created by God, had no beach at all. It was totally landlocked. They emphasized the deluge in Genesis, that is, the passages dealing with the inundation of the earth, that was a kind of realized metaphor of divine judgment and wrath. They understood that the world as initially created by God had been a place of smooth contours and gradual movement between sea and land. Once the waters of the deluge retreated, they left behind this scarred, ravaged landscape and these rough margins that called attention to the presence of the divine. And the New Testament, they looked at those texts that showed the beach as being associated with Christ's calling together disciples, with his miracles, walking on water, and so on. So the beach was assimilated into Christian ideology as a place of divine wrath and punishment and as a place on which to set up monasteries and nunneries. We also have to understand it in terms of a general aquaphobia from which the Christians suffered. That is, that to be unclean is to be holy, as all part of this program of the abnegation of the flesh in the interest of otherworldliness.
So when did the beach begin to be viewed as something healthful and actually begin to be commercialized?
Well, actually, that happened in the mid-17th century. The therapeutic beach was a British invention, and generally we credit Dr. Robert Whitty for setting up the first therapeutic sea bath on the beach at Scarborough, England. The 18th century is a kind of period in which one physician after another, one medical expert after another, began to jump on this bandwagon of the therapeutic, the curative cold bath. As the beach was discovered and shaped by the British in the 17th and 18th century, it was an entirely winter phenomenon. The bathing season extended from November through the end of April, and people were bathing in those gelid North Sea waters. Why was this? Because they discovered a cold water as a therapeutic regimen. Dr. Richard Russell in 1750, for example, followed up on an earlier treatise from 1702 on cold bathing, on the use of seawater, in which he argued that immersion in cold water was the best cure for shut-ins, for frail children, for adolescent girls about to embark on the perils of reproduction, beneficial to young aristocrats as a corrective for bodily and spiritual infirmities. And there were all sorts of very complex, very sophisticated physiological theories that were marshaled in support of cold water, water bathing. In fact, these immersive therapies were also supplemented by the consumption of seawater, so that bathers signed up for complex regimens that involved quaffing huge doses of seawater, quarts of it a day, in order to purge worms and or normalize the digestive system and so on. To our perspective, of course, this was entirely punitive and a really devastating approach to the beach, but it worked, it caught on, and when the British royalty jumped on it in the end of the 18th century, it became all the rage, spreading across the channel to the continent, and resorts, therapeutic resorts were set up at all along the Atlantic coast and on the Baltic.
Now, part of this commercialization and is this heliotherapy, for example, and this healthfulness, this heliotherapy that you discuss in your book, and it goes to the notion of the development of the women's swimsuit. Can you say a few things about that?
Yes, the 19th century swimming costume was a very cumbersome a concoction of that involved 50 yards of heavy woolen fabric, corsets, gloves, shoes, a parasol, obviously not fit for swimming at all. This is because the aspect of beach therapy that was valued in the 19th century as opposed to the 18th century was the air component. People came to the beach in the 19th century as a cure for tuberculosis, to breathe the fresh air of the beach. And so this cumbersome dress was not an obstacle to their therapy. However, by the end of the 19th century, the swimming immersion in the water again became part of the therapeutic regimen, and this is where the slow, gradual strip begins, actually, the attempt to streamline the bathing costume. The biggest boost in this direction came from a revolution, a medical revolution again, that is the discovery of the sun as the principal restorative agent sometime during immediately before and during World War I. And, of course, now the imperative, or the therapeutic imperative, was to expose as much of the body as possible to the air. And stripping of the exposure of the human body so was motivated by this therapeutic imperative, as well as, of course, by fashion and by political developments. We have to remember that what happens on the beach is very much a concentrated, encapsulated form, a reflection of what is happening at society at large. So combined with the drive for the liberalization of women, the campaigns for the early campaigns for women's rights that marked the first two decades of the 20th century, the health movement, athletic movement, the campaigns to teach people how to swim, to move in the water, the emergence of female athletes, all of these prompted this gradual reduction of the swim costume. Now, as for the particular forms that the swimsuit took, this is absolutely fascinating and is part of the erotic history of the costume. The human body in its natural form is actually quite boring, it is only that clothing, in fact, serves as a kind of erotic italics that calls attention, that re-eroticizes certain parts of the body. And when we look at the development of the swimsuit in the 20th century, we see that each decade seems to fix on a different part of the female anatomy to expose, to call into question. So in the 20s, for example, the swimsuit reveals the bare arm and the bare leg. leg. In the 30s, the back is exposed. In the 40s, it is, in the 50s, it's the bosom, which is highlighted by various supportive devices. In the 60s, the navel is finally revealed. In the 70s and 80s, it's the upper thigh. So there is, these migrating erogenous zones are always highlighted by the swimsuit at the beach.
Well, I'm afraid that's all the time we have for today.
Oh, too bad.
Okay, well, but thank you very much,
You're
Dr.
welcome.
Lenchek. We have been talking with Dr. Lena Lenchek, professor of Russian literature and humanities at Reed College and co-author of The Beach, The History of Paradise on Earth.
To get to the beach, most of you are going to use the family car. But before you do that, maybe you should take a moment for Jane Holtz Kay's thoughts on the automobile and its impact on the nation. Kay is the architecture and planning critic for The Nation and the author of Asphalt Nation, How the Automobile Took Over America and How We Can Take It Back.
If you're fueling up on pricey petrol or stewing on congested highways this summer, you may be wondering just how we got stuck in traffic and stuck on car dependency. Yes, you know we live in an asphalt nation, but don't let the myths of a free ride and the lure of open spaces convince you that we were born to drive. It was ourselves and our history that gave us today's car-bred sprawl, that created immobility and inequity, the hassles of everyday life, and the destruction and degradation of the environment. It was a series of reasonable and unreasonable subsidies, intended and unintended consequences, that made us pave the continent and need a ton or more of steel and wheel to buy a quart of milk. When Henry Ford gave Americans the Model T in 1908, he supplied the machine for the masses. The Good Roads Movement, part the offspring of the bicyclists, part a tool to help the farmer get his goods to market, was boosted along. At every step, the car and car parts manufacturers combined with the folks stuck in rutted roads to pave the way. Rail succumbed to the road. The builders who had constructed and maintained trolley lines to create our streetcar suburbs and streetcar cities couldn't compete. The developers, now given a free road, had no transportation expenses. Sound familiar? Government did the rest. In the Depression era, Roosevelt sent half his WPA funds to pick and shovel road jobs, and conspiring automakers brought down the rail to sell their buses. The 50s and 60s promoted the heyday of the highway. The federally funded interstate took Americans to the federally subsidized suburbs. Meanwhile, federally funded urban renewal slayed the walkable city to save it. The rest, as they say, is history. That history lives on, as today's federal government spends $4 out of every $5 on the road, while local governments fail to plan and let developers build on the fringes, taking us ever outwards. No wonder we have more sprawl and mounting mileage. No wonder, more happily, a new generation of light rail and transit-oriented design is taking place even in cities like Phoenix and Dallas. Activists and officials are working to reinforce older city centers and neighborhoods with their dense rail-friendly patterns. Walkers, bikers, and those who believe in car-free places are promoting better planning. The drive for a sustainable landscape is combining with the anti-car concerns to help us stop going down the road feeling bad, as the song has it. And more important, to swap the bygone freedom of the road for a true freedom to move without a ton of wheel and steel.
You've been listening to Jane Holtz Kay, author of Asphalt Nation, How the Automobile Took Over America and How We Can Take It Back. This is Talking History. For our site of the week, we thought we would recommend a place where you can go to the beach and enjoy some historic sites at the same time. Here to tell you about one such site is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
St. Augustine, Florida is one of the nation's oldest cities. The pre-colonial village has 144 blocks of historic houses, and it's nestled between the Atlantic Ocean and the Intercoastal Waterway. St. Augustine provides 24 miles of unspoiled beaches, perfect for exploring and relaxing. Of course, if you're also looking for a little adventure, there is plenty of that as well. There are three forts to explore, and in one of them you will find the chambers used in the 1800s as prison cells for Indians. And just outside the city gates of St. Augustine, you will find the site of Fort Moses that was the first legally sanctioned settlement of black people in 1738. There is much to see and do in St. Augustine, but there is also plenty of space to just sit and relax.
And finally, turning to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions, we'd like to call to your attention a select list of the Public Broadcasting System's worldwide web service sites intended to enhance its summer programs by providing a site where you can learn more about some of the topics covered in its television programs. For example, PBS offers further information and links to other resources on Dietrich Bonhoeffer, a German religious scholar who resisted the Nazis during World War II and who was the subject of the PBS production Bonhoeffer, Agent of Grace. Death of the Dream, Farmhouses in the Heartland, intended as an online companion to the show of the same title, views the evolution of the American farm and farmhouse, including brief histories, stories, poetry, photography, and even a virtual farmhouse. Remember, these and more sites are available on the PBS website, pbs.org. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our program and that you will join us next week when we'll take a look at the history of the Harley-Davidson motorcycle and its impact on American popular culture. In the meantime, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. From the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.